Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
On this vote, the yeas are 216. The nays are 210. The resolution is adopted. Without objection, the motion to reconsider is laid on the table. The office of Speaker of the House of the United States House of Representatives is hereby declared vacant.
With that, Representative Kevin McCarthy removed as Speaker of the House.
I'll continue to help all the way possible. Look, I've been very fortunate. When I came to Congress in my second term, I got to be Chief Deputy Whip. I got to be Majority Whip. I got to be Majority Leader. I've been Minority Leader, and I've been Speaker. I've been blessed. And there's something about 10,000 hours. I believe in it, a lot of different experience. And I believe in bringing new blood up and helping them, and I want to help them all the way.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
No question, as a national security measure, we like the fact that we produce more than we consume in this country, right? It provides a buffer. It provides security for our nation that a lot of the rest of the world does not have.
Co-director of the Ag and Food Policy Center at Texas A&M, Dr. Bart Fisher, responding to a Washington Post editorial calling for the end of farm programs.
No question, too, that on average, we do end up, exporting some of that production overseas as well to areas where they are calorie deficit. I too look at that as a good thing. Again, like you said at the outset, it doesn't mean it's perfect, right? And, we have to operate on the averages. But again, if you go back to where we started, we've had a $90 billion infusion into agriculture outside of a farm bill over the last 5 years. And frankly, if you took that away, the net farm income picture would look a lot different, right? And so it's a bit rich to follow that infusion with an argument that we don't need a farm bill. The reality is, the preference, and I think most growers would agree, the preference is to not have to do the ad hoc assistance that's considerably more costly. It would be much better to build that in to a predictable standing farm safety net. And I think the editorial board knows full well that a significant share of that income came from that ad hoc infusion. And that's one of the challenges with ad hoc aid. It's done at the end of the year, generally in sweeping fashion, not in a specific, the Washington Post pokes fun at the fact that it's very specific and farm policy is in the weeds. It's because Congress writes it that way to address very specific problems, as opposed to the ad hoc aid, which is just essentially, here's $10 billion, Secretary of Agriculture, go try to solve some problems, right? Or $20 billion or whatever it may be. And so Congress is much more prescriptive on purpose. It's so the aid will be targeted to the need. And so my preference is for good, for solid standing policy, despite the fact they poke fun of it.
That was on the point, we produce more calories than we need, but spending cuts, not the way to go either.
So if you look at the 14 farm bill, there was a $23 billion deficit reduction in that bill. And I think at the time was the only bill that Congress that moved with mandatory money. You also look at the consequence of the last deficit reduction exercise, of the last debt ceiling. The last time we had a really significant conversation about cutting the deficit during that discussion resulted in sequestration, and agriculture makes up a huge share of that. If you take out non-Medicare, non-defense mandatory sequestration, agriculture historically has accounted for about 30% of it, which is wildly disproportional. Agriculture does more than its share. And so, agriculture has not been spared. And quite frankly, agriculture is probably given more than most others have. I am worried about some of these proposals that float around out there. One of them that came up in this editorial, particularly on crop insurance. And the idea is, well, if you're a bigger grower, you shouldn't need access to crop insurance. And there's a lot of reasons to push back on that statement. There's a lot of in the weeds reasons in terms of, actuarial science, why you need a big, broad pool of people. The one that concerns me most, though, is that if you do have bigger producers or landowners, for example, that may not even be on the farm, but they're still sharing in the risk of that operation, if they can't insure their share, who's the risk going to go to? The risk is going to go to the tenant, and the tenant is going to assume all of that risk as they continue to get even bigger, right? And so I love this because you have folks who know absolutely nothing about production agriculture coming up with harebrained ideas where they have no clue of the real world consequences. And it's fun to poke fun and say, well, it's just because a couple of folks in Washington and in the cabal understand this. But the reality is it has real world implications out on the ground with respect to farmers and ranchers who have to live under these policies.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
One of the main things that consumers are concerned about, and even if they want to eat beef, is how it's handled. So,
Dr. Ron Gill is professor and Texas A&M Extension Livestock Specialist on cattle handling.
The welfare component is one of them that I think is a major reason it's kind of become a mainstream topic. And then also, we've got a lot of really good animal health products on the market. And we're still seeing an increase in sickness rate, in particular bovine respiratory disease and some other things that are directly linked to stress levels in cattle. So if we can improve the way we handle cattle and don't stress them as much in the marketing, transportation sectors, and at the ranch level as well, we have a tendency to have better health in those cattle as they go through that transition from the cow-calf level into the stocker and feedlot phase. So there's a lot of reasons that we talk about it, but we try to improve the welfare of the cattle. We try to improve the health of the cattle. And the biggest thing that I really stress is the safety of the people working the cattle. If we can get them to work in a little better and understand behavior a little better, cattle are much more predictable in their response, and we don't see near as many people getting hurt. So that's the maybe the side benefit to improving cattle handling. We think about it from the cattle side, but there's not much more expensive than somebody getting hurt on the ranch.
And there are transportation issues.
Think about how many times a calf gets on and off a trailer or a truck. It's probably between 3 and 8 times before he goes to the market, to the meat counter. And so cow-calf guy may load him on a trailer, haul him to an auction market. Somebody buys him, they load him, they haul him to preconditioning or order buying yard, unload him, load him again as they put together groups. They move to preconditioning. Then they move to wheat pasture, then they move to a feedlot, and then they move to a packing plant. So we don't really think about how many times we put cattle on and off trucks. But the way we handle them and the stockmanship used to put them on and off trucks can make that a very pleasant experience for the cattle or a very bad one. And so we put a lot of effort into training people how to load cattle, but it all starts with how they were handled at the ranch and how they were sorted. All those things, we want to keep cattle thinking, not reacting to people. And so that's why we kind of really work on looking at this from a systems approach. It's not one sector's responsibility. It's every sector's responsibility to handle cattle better.
And fortunately here, size doesn't matter.
You don't have to have a big elaborate set of corrals. You do need something, a catch pen, something a little smaller to get them close to a processing area. And you may not need a chute, but I think you need a head gate. You need some way to restrain that animal that you can do some work on them. There's some lower cost squeeze chutes, use squeeze chutes. Find something that is safe. Some of these old chutes are not real safe when they start to wear out, but get one that's safe and something you can have there. The other thing is have a good place to load trailers. And that's one thing we don't think about. We only use it once or twice a year. And we really don't think about it. But if we're having trouble loading cows, that increases shrink on our cattle. So as we design a pen, have a good place you can back a trailer up to and load out of. There's some of the sweet tubs and bud boxes we talk about, but all of them are really good for loading cattle. So kind of see what you got. But that's one of the things I see a lot of places. Even our dairymen don't have good places to load cattle. They may have 6,000-7,000 head of cows standing around, but when it gets time to get rid of some of them, they don't have a place to load them. So we need to really think about that. It doesn't have to be elaborate, but it needs to be safe and something that makes sense to a cow to get on a trailer.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
From the plant breeding perspective, we see a great deal of investment coming out.
Referring to CRISPR technology, Andy Levine, CEO, American Seed Trade Association.
And when we look at agriculture research, this technology was really perfected through our land-grant institutions and through our research institutions here in the U.S. and now has been brought out into both the public and private sector. So many of our research institutions and land-grants and others are using these techniques and teaching our future PhDs and plant breeders these techniques. And it's right now we're looking at what is the policy around the use of these, as we've seen in various other arenas within biotechnology. You know, the GMO regulations were somewhat burdensome and not evolving like we would have liked to see, so more crops could use them. we want to make sure as our plant breeding tools change and improve and we get new innovations, they aren't put in that same bucket as GMO. Very strong supporters of GMO technology, and we would like to see that continue. But somewhat the regulatory burden has become so heavy on a global basis that it's very difficult for many companies to be involved in that arena. And so as we change our breeding techniques and we bring new things to the table, what is important is what does the regulatory landscape look like and what do countries decide to do policy-wise in order to encourage and facilitate the implementation of these types of techniques all across the plant breeding spectrum and not just in a couple of major field crops.
So how does this CRISPR technology work?
CRISPR can be used to create a transgene or a biotech product, a GMO product. But it's right now is mainly the focus is in using creating new varieties through mutagenesis. It's a new form of mutagenesis that we can use in order to create those new varieties. And what it enables us to do is really target those specific characteristics within a genetic code that either makes the plant more susceptible to a plant or disease or resistant to a plant and disease. Can you turn up resistance? Can you turn off susceptibility? Can you bring in from another plant a shorter stalk in corn? Can you bring in from another, another corn plant, not a plant outside the family? Can you bring in a soybean? Can you bring in another from a plant that soybean variety that may not perform as well or yield as well, but it has really good oil content? Can you bring that oil, those oil characteristics in and replace them in this one that produces very well yield-wise, but it has subpar oil qualities? And all you do is change that oil characteristics. And so we can do this in a lot of different plants because we now know most of what makes the plant do what it does. And so being able to target those, and as you say, it's very straightforward. It's pretty much turning off or turning on or replacing with genes from a plant within the family that have those characteristics that you want to incorporate.
And now we have CRISPR in food.
A company called Pairwise has come to the marketplace, or is coming to the marketplace. They got approval and have gone through the process of a new lettuce. It's a nutrition-rich mustard green that's very quite tasty. I've had the opportunity to try it, and it's very rich in nutrients that are favorable for us, and it's got double, from what I understand, it's got double the nutrition of romaine lettuce. And so they're coming to market with that. They're going through the process of, you know, customer approval and acceptance and all of those kind of things. So we've got a number of things in the pipeline that the companies are working with, but this is going to be the first one of its kind coming to the market here soon.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
We stopped agreeing to appoint a pellet body member, just to be absolutely clear for the audience. We, you know, Obama started it, we continued it, and the Biden administration has continued it.
World Trade Organization became a thorn in the side of the U.S. Jameson Greer, former chief of staff for the U.S. Trade Representative.
It's been supported by, you know, Senator Wyden and Senator Crapo and Senator Grassley before Senator Crapo. So this is something that's widely recognized as an issue. And so what do you do, right? What do you do in the absence of the WTO? I think it is important as well to level set about, you know, what happened before, right? When we would say, oh, well, before there was enforcement, we could go to the WTO. You know, to David's point, you know, it may be that early on things were more effective, but I mean, when we were at USTR, we were still dealing with disputes that were 10, 12, 13, 14 years old without resolution. Boeing, Airbus, beef hormones. And notably, those are with the EU, who's supposed to be, right, simpatico with international trade rules. We had issues with China on films and the films we could have in the market. I mean, just so when we say there was really good enforcement beforehand with the WTO, I mean, I don't agree with that proposition. And so the idea that, oh, well, what do we do now? The question kind of presumes that before it was like a really effective thing, right? When in reality, it couldn't capture a lot of Chinese non-market activities. Anyway, so in the absence of, you know, a demonstrated ability of the WTO to not be very effective with respect to U.S. policy, what do you do in its absence? Section 301 is something David referred to. It's Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974. It gives the president authority. It's been delegated to USTR to investigate unfair or discriminatory trade practices. that burden U.S. business, U.S. commerce unreasonably. And coming out of that investigation, if we find violations that there are trade practices by foreign governments who have policies and practices that, you know, meet those standards, then there are two things you can do. If you have a policy or practice that falls underneath a trade agreement that has a dispute settlement procedure, you have to go that way. The legislation as revised requires you to go that way. If there are policies and practices that aren't captured under a trade agreement with a dispute settlement system, then you can do other things. And it gives pretty broad remit to the administration, to the president, to be able to impose tariffs, impose quotas, assess fees on services, otherwise restrict market access. And so when we did the section, you know, we did an investigation under 301 in the Trump administration. We found that China had been engaged in policies and procedures on forced technology transfer for many years. We found harm, very conservative harm, of $50 billion annually. The harms that we found, there were a variety of different ways of forced tech transfer. One of these having to do with discriminatory licensing fell underneath the TRIPS agreement, which is the WTO agreement on trade-related aspects of intellectual property. And so we brought a case with respect to that. But with respect to a lot of the other things that were going on, you know, cyber hacking, you know, trade secret theft, other types of things, that was not actionable under TRIPS. And so we went with domestic U.S. authority under Section 301 to impose tariffs. And then there are other things that can be done. You know, David referred to you know, Section 201, which has always been something, right? Anti-dumping countervailing duty laws, that's always been there. Those are things that are, you know, nominally authorized by the WTO, you know, despite their adverse rulings against some of those things. We have Section 232, which is a national security-based tool. It's not really a trade tool. It's national security, but it has big trade effects. So there are certainly other things that the president can do to enforce, you know, trade laws with respect to other countries, even without the WTO.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I think one of the bigger concerns or, you know, complaints that people have or worries is that they think that checkoff dollars are being used on policy issues. And that's, you know, clearly forbidden in the Beef Act, which is the law that sets up the program.
Greg Haynes is CEO of the Cattlemen's Beef Board, the Beef Checkoff. Talks about working with NCBA as a checkoff contractor.
And so we have, you know, very clear policies or, you know, I guess procedures and policies to ensure that that doesn't happen. So NCBA and other contractors who do policy work, you know, they have internal firewalls and practices that they have set up. We verify and review all those. And then we also go and we're reviewing costs and expenses that they're submitting to us and making sure that they don't fall into that realm. And so it's a very robust program. And so I'm very confident, you know, I can tell you that, no, checkoff dollars are not being used for any policy work with our contractors. And, you know, the contractors have to do the programs first, and then they submit reimbursements. And so that's another good check, because if they're doing something that they're not supposed to do, we're not paying them back. And so that's a huge risk for them if they're spending this money and then, you know, they don't get paid back for it.
Few recent attacks from members of Congress on checkoffs, but Haynes says the proof's in the pudding.
35 years ago, a dollar a head. 35 years later, it's still a dollar a head. So we've probably lost almost 40% in purchasing power just from, you know, inflation. And then if you look at it too, we're producing more beef with less cattle. So that's also had an impact on the number of checkoff dollars we have. So I think that makes it even more prudent that, you know, we are really looking at those programs that provide the biggest bang for their buck and the biggest impact to the producers. And so the whole process that we're doing here at the convention this week, you know, we have producer committees that are looking at all of these different programs and giving feedback and ideas to those contractors. And the contractors take all this back. And then next month we'll meet in Denver again, and they'll present it to the operating committee, and the operating committee will then decide which of these programs they want to fund, because there's always greater demand for programs than available funding. So they're going to have to cut things to be able to fit into that budget that we'll have. So they'll look at that and make those decisions. But I think the contractors and everyone have done a great job in adapting and using new technologies. I mean, things that we used to do in the past, you know, like running a big network ad. I mean, at that time it worked, but now nobody sits around and watches network TV all the day. You know, there's not the TV show Dallas or something where everybody's got to watch Who Shot JR. Yeah, so everybody's on social media and all that. So now we're able to use those mediums to keep targeting the audiences that we're looking at. And so that's ended up being very, very effective and a lot of times a lot more cost effective. So technology, I think, has helped us be able to keep pace with that. But I think at a certain stage, it's going to be tough. You know, we're getting squeezed every year and we have a lot of competition out there. You've got, you know, the artificial meat companies out there who are getting, you know, one got $700 million in funding last year, and they use a lot of that to promote their product, which is usually by dissing beef. You know, we're better than beef nutritionally. Beef's bad for the environment, all these things. So that's where I think the checkoff is really going to have to play an important role to counter all that and show how nutritious and safe and delicious and good for the environment beef is. And we have the stories of these producers. I mean, we've got everything we need, so we just need to get out there and continue to promote that.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The 1985 Farm Bill brought in the conservation cross-compliance rules, and in a nutshell, what those rules required was that a farmer, to be eligible for farm program benefits, had to have a conservation plan for the farm.
Roger McCohen is a tax law specialist with Washburn University. He talks about swamp buster rules.
So we got all types of conservation programs that came along with the 85 Farm Bill, including the Conservation Reserve Program and including the swamp buster rules. So what the swamp buster rules basically said was that you can't convert a wetland, and that's going to be the key term, to crop production if you want to receive farm program payments. And there were only a couple of minor exceptions to that. One was for prior converted cropland. In other words, if you had already converted a wet area or what's deemed to be a wetland to crop production prior to the effective date of the 1985 Farm Bill, that was okay. But again, that led to litigation on that particular issue. But that was one of the exceptions. But basically, the swamp buster rules say don't touch the wet areas, don't convert them to crop production if you want farm program benefits.
Now, McCohen admits that over the past 40 years, we have seen some rule changes.
Well, some of the initial rules that were put in defined what a wetland was, and you had to have three characteristics. You had to have hydric soil and hydrophytic vegetation or hydrophytic plants, plants that would grow in a wet area, and wetland hydrology. You had to have all three of those. So it was soil type and vegetation type and hydrology type that defined what a wetland is. And then in 1996, Senator Grassley from Iowa, who is still a senator from Iowa in the U.S. Senate, dealt with an issue by amending the swamp buster rules to say that a delineation that's been made by NRCS of a wetland for a farmer couldn't change unless the farmer requested a new delineation. What was happening in the early 1990s, about 5-6 years into the swamp buster rules, was that NRCS started using aerial photography to delineate wet areas, in areas that would be wetlands. And so you'd have a previous delineation that would suddenly change on a farmer, and what was not defined to be a wetland now is defined because of aerial photography. And it was creating all types of uncertainty for farmers. They would start planting, here comes a new delineation, now this is a wet area, and they would have the rules change on them suddenly. And so Senator Grassley came in and said, no, you can't do that. We're amending the statute. And so this is a statutory change, and said that a prior wetland certification shall remain valid and in effect until the time that the person affected by the certification requests a review. And there was no mention, that's the end of the statutory language, there was no mention of giving the NRCS the ability to write regulations to carry out that rule, but they did. USDA developed a regulation known as the review regulation that set up procedural requirements that a farmer had to follow to make an effective review request. In other words, they were saying, well, you can't just request a review of us at any given time. you have to show that some type of natural event had altered the topography or the hydrology of the land, or you have to show that we made a mistake, or we admit we made a mistake. So those were the two conditions to getting a review. But otherwise, the statute said that NRCS had to do a new delineation if a farmer requested it.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
The end of the marketing year for corn and soybeans. What does this mean for supplies? USDA's latest quarterly stocks report indicates corn down 1% from this time last year and beans down 2% year over year.
I don't think that there was a huge surprise in terms of where the stocks in aggregate turned out. I think that those were, relatively speaking, within the range of trade expectations, maybe a little bit more soybean stocks than folks had anticipated at the higher end of that range. And I think you are seeing the market respond to that. Maybe higher end of the range there on soybean stocks, putting a little downward pressure on soybeans.
Chief economist Seth Meyer adds that all wheat stocks are up slightly from 1 year ago, the current number at 1.78 billion bushels. He also notes that perhaps most surprising from the quarterly stocks report, more stocks held by farmers than by commercial entities. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.